Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're going to open today with Connecticut Office of Policy and Management Secretary Ben Barnes talking about a brand new statewide website that helps residents and state employees fight fraud, waste, and abuse that costs tens of millions of dollars each year. Check it out yourself. It's fightfraud.ct.gov. Then we'll continue our focus on the opioid epidemic sweeping Connecticut with MCCA, one of the state's leading providers of addiction recovery services, not only for individuals addicted to opioids or heroin, but also folks dealing with codependence or addictions to nicotine and gambling. Then we'll wrap welcoming Alexion Pharmaceuticals back to New Haven, promoting a first-of-its-kind partnership with the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. Those two partners just launched Here in New Haven, a charitable giving initiative providing microgrants to 30 local nonprofit organizations before the end of February. We'll even talk to one of those organizations. We'll be back with those segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Yes, I can hear them now. The sounds of the Coastal Chordsmen Quartets. They'll be serenading singing Valentines to loved ones from Friday, February 12th to Sunday, February 14th in Fairfield and New Haven counties. You can hire four tuxedo-clad gentlemen to sing a song and present a card, a chocolate lollipop, and a rose to somebody you care about, or upgrade to a dozen roses and a $25 gift card from restaurant.com. All proceeds help support student scholarships and charitable organizations. If you'd like to order your Coastal Chordsmen singing Valentine, call 203-816-0462 for the Coastal Chordsmen. It's been a while since we talked to Ben Barnes. He is Secretary of Connecticut's Office of Policy and Management, OPM. And for the most part, when we see Ben talking in the media, he's talking about financial issues and budgetary issues in Connecticut. And it's always great to share some additional good news. We learned just a few days ago that the state of Connecticut has launched a website to help in efforts at fighting fraud, waste, and abuse that cost state programs and you, taxpayers, tens of millions of dollars each year. So, Ben, welcome to the program, and thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to the folks across the state about this important new project. Tell us a little bit about the ramp up to launching fightfraud.ct.gov.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. This is an important subject and one that I'm very appreciative of you for covering. We have a significant amount of money that we spend every year on health care in particular through the Medicaid program, but also through our state employee and retiree health care programs. We ensure we're the payer, essentially, for over a million Connecticut residents or state employee, state retirees who live out of state. And with that comes an extraordinary number of individual claims that are paid out. And while the vast majority of those are appropriate claims, high-quality medical services by appropriate providers, and the claims are fine, there are always, or have always been, and we're trying to reduce this, some number of claims that are fraudulent, where people don't follow the rules for how to, what kind of claims they should be filing for. The claims are don't reflect the services that were provided. The services were not appropriate. They're made up out of whole cloth in some cases, and we need to have an active ongoing program to root those out. This website is only one part of a large multi-agency effort to reduce fraud in our, particularly in our medical assistance programs.
Well, tell us about your which agencies you're partnering with.
Well, the Department of Social Services, which is the agency that runs our Medicaid program, has for a long time maintained a program integrity unit that does audits of providers and identifies fraud based on a whole series of different approaches. They get tips from the public. They analyze trends, and in utilization. They look at all the data that comes over the transom in the form of claims that are filed by providers, et cetera, and they try to identify fraudsters, and they pursue those through audits and, in some cases, through referral to law enforcement. However, a few years ago, the legislature said they wanted us to redouble our efforts in order to find some budgetary savings. We would rather cut money out of fraud than cutting it out of other areas in the government.
Program, sure.
So while their target was maybe a little steeper in the short run than we would have liked, just because you know it's always hard to predict how much money you'll save by fighting fraud, we took the effort very seriously. We built a group under OPM's leadership involving DSS, other human service agencies, the Attorney General's office, the state's attorney, and others. We added some expansions to what we call the to our ability under what's called the False Claims Act for us to receive civil settlements in the event of people who've lied in their met claims for reimbursement to the Connecticut medical assistance programs, and that effort has, I think, really begun to pay off. We've developed more technology-intensive ways to develop leads, so we're better able to comb through the mountains of data to identify patterns which might suggest fraud. We've been working with national organizations very closely to identify sort of cutting edge in fraud. I mean, this is like any industry, people who want to defraud state governments' medical assistance programs, they develop new approaches and they learn from one another about those approaches. Individuals involved in fraud go from one state to another and execute schemes that have been successful in one place and another. Mm. And we're doing everything we can to identify those trends and support them.
Well, let me stop you on that point, Mr. Barnes. This seems like these transient operators are kind of insulated, like a kind of like a closed shop effect. So, by utilizing fightfraud.ct.gov. How would an individual outside of the scheme beyond the direct perpetrators of the fraud, how would they know or even suspect that something might be wrong to be able to then tip off Connecticut officials to go after it?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that you might. I mean, we all know what a regular. I mean, if a local provider that you do business with appears to be engaging in a practice that doesn't make any sense to you and might be reflective of fraud, I would encourage you to report it. I mean, if there's someone out there who, if you go into a store and you see that they are, taking a SNAP card or a food stamp card and giving cash back to the person who's presenting it, that may well be fraud.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not supposed to do that. If there are people who are, treating patients who at a medical practice that you're at, and the treatments take no time at all, and appear to be executed on healthy people who are lining up in the waiting room. If you think it's fraud, we'd like to know about it, and we'd like to take a look.
Oh, and with that, you bring up an important point because anyone who makes a tip doesn't automatically launch an assumption of guilt. It simply launches the vetting of that accusation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we investigate lots and lots of things, if we can identify, we hold ourselves to very strict standards for identifying overpayments or fraud, and we certainly would take that responsibility very, very seriously. But we need evidence to do that. I mean, for instance, some of the cases that have happened have been reported on and concluded involved providing unnecessary services, unnecessary claims. So if a physician or a provider is appears to be billing insurance or appears to be asking you to sign off on claims that are beyond the level of the services that you provided, we'd like to know about that.
Okay.
Because that may be an indication. I mean, I understand it's complicated. Mm. Sometimes many of us, myself included, may not understand every aspect of the medical procedure claiming process. But to the extent that we see something going on that we don't understand, I would rather have our investigators look into it and make sure it's on the up and up.
Yeah, and I have to believe a lot of times people feel in their gut or instinctively that something just seems wrong, and there's nothing wrong with making that suspicion or concern, bringing that to the attention of your office through the fightfraud.ct.gov, a new website. And you also have a lot of situations, I guess, where people who may be receiving services or for whatever other reason, they may be wary of some sort of retribution, or that they'll end up having to come back around and be sitting, in court pointing a finger at somebody saying, yes, I saw him or her do that. What wherewithal does this site provide for anonymous tips, or perhaps maybe we should come at this by talking about the experience that somebody has when they click on fightfraud.ct.gov.
Well, our website allows for a whole variety of fraud to be reported. We connect to the national fightstopfraud.gov website, where you can report all kinds of frauds, whether it's a mortgage fraud or student loan fraud or identity theft or cyber crimes. I mean, there are a whole series of links that you can make to appropriate federal agencies. In addition, we have within the state system, we would allow you to report healthcare fraud, workers' compensation fraud, fraudulent use of state services and some of the major human service programs. There are connections to the tax department and others if you want to report fraud. As to whether or not it would the ability to remain anonymous is certainly something that I'm sure we would attempt to respect, although there are a great number of laws related to that.
We
may, in fact, need to follow up on an allegation, but we certainly would welcome any kind of tip that people want to provide us, and we'll sort through it and try to get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm. I also see that an important part of the website provides ways for the public to report suspected aspects of unfair competition. Could you explain that?
Unfair competition covers a series of things that might come under the auspices of our Department of Consumer Protection.
Mm-hmm.
So that would involve things like price gouging or misleading advertising that someone is doing.
Oh, I see. So
sort of unfair trade practices that are done at the if a store advertises something for sale and then doesn't have that available, or is otherwise engaging in some kind of unfair practice in the marketplace, and then our Department of Consumer Protection would investigate that.
I understand. So this all came from the Governor Malloy's Interagency Fraud Task Force in 2013, and you did talk a little bit about the challenge to try to quantify how much the effort is worth it in terms of the dollars saved in mitigating or stemming these fraudulent practices. So tell us a little bit about the numbers that you've been able to rack up just since November 2013.
Yeah, well, since then we have we can quantify tens of millions of dollars in savings where we have identified particular bills that we don't have to pay because they're fraudulent. We've recaptured money that we've recouped money that we've paid out in what we later discovered to have been fraudulent circumstances. However, it's what's the hardest part to look at is if, say, there's a medical provider who is billing for services that haven't been performed, and we catch them based on activity over a several month period, and that's worth tens of thousands of dollars. That may seem like we've stopped tens of thousands of dollars. We've saved that money by not paying for those claims. But if that provider was, without our efforts, going to go continuing to bill for those services into the future, we may well have saved many times more than the nominal amount that we identified in our investigation by shutting somebody down.
Yeah.
So program integrity has enormous impact on the long-term costs of running a program if everyone who's involved knows that they cannot undertake organized exploitation or organized fraudulent claiming or anything like that without being caught, then we can limit our expenses to those that are necessary, and the savings there are quite considerable. So it's very hard for me to say, we've considered trying to be more aggressive about how we quantify the savings when we've uncovered and disrupted a fraud, but we've tried to stick only to those numbers that are easily demonstrable based on the recoveries or the claims at issue. But again, I think the savings are much greater than that. And frankly, this is other people's money we're talking about.
Right,
this is public funds, and integrity is terribly important. So it's
money.
Worth investigating frauds, even if it costs us a few thousand dollars to uncover a relatively small fraud that may not have had huge financial consequences, but undermines public integrity and undermines confidence that the taxpayers have in their government services.
And also from a person's perspective, if they suspect, or even if they know there's some fraud going on, but to them they're thinking, it's just a few dollars, or it's just $20 or $30 every month or every visit or whatever, and then they hear about this fightfraud.ct.gov website, maybe they'll be inclined to go there if they start to begin doing the math and saying, wait a minute, if this is involving some sort of a provider, and when I go in the waiting room there's always 30 people in front of me and 30 people behind me, then you start adding up that few dollars or that 20 or that $50, and boom, I mean, these are my tax dollars. These are your tax dollars, right?
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, and there's no question that we are able to eliminate tens of millions of dollars of expenses every year. Tens of millions of dollars, it varies. It's hard to exactly quantify what that number is, but those are sums that are enormously consequential to our ability to provide all the services we want. I mean, I hear criticisms all the time from people about one budget cut or another, or one area of expansion or another that people are advocating for, which is smaller than that. Having those resources available to provide more services for people with developmental disabilities, or to expand mental health services, or to reduce taxes. All those are much better uses of money than paying for the hidden costs of fraud.
Right. Kind of capitalizing on the established idea of see something, say something. The state of Connecticut has launched a website to help efforts at fighting fraud, waste, and abuse that cost state programs tens of millions of dollars each year. To date, tens of millions of dollars already saved for taxpayers, and all it takes is to go to fightfraud.ct.gov. Our guest today, Ben Barnes, Secretary of the Connecticut Office of Policy and Management, cluing us in on the work that they're doing and the importance of if you even have a suspicion that somebody might be defrauding the state of Connecticut and you and I as taxpayers, go to fightfraud.cd.gov. Ben Barnes, great to speak with you on this important matter. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again soon. It's been a while since we checked in with MCCA, the Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism. And I have to say, over the past year or so, the amount of information and reporting on the opioid epidemic that's gripping the nation and is costing lives every day here in Connecticut has been pretty widespread. But a lot of the reporting is kind of dealing with the numbers and just coming to grips with the sheer volume of addictions and deaths that opioids are causing here, particularly in Connecticut. Our program is endeavoring to start drilling in a little bit deeper on this, as we really always have for the past 2.5 decades that I've been working on for the people. It's been an issue that's been a constant in terms of the way it's affecting the communities that our radio stations serve. And we're pleased to have a long-standing partnership with MCCA. They're one of the largest providers of substance abuse treatment in Connecticut, and they've been actively involved with a number of prevention councils and other community-centric prevention and addiction organizations and addiction response organizations. I'm pleased to welcome to the program this morning our good friend Joe Sullivan. He's CEO of MCCA. And we're going to talk about a number of really exciting things going on at the agency. Joe, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So just orient folks that are maybe listening elsewhere on our stations throughout the state beyond my introduction. Just tell us a little bit about the agency and the jurisdiction that you serve. If I'm not mistaken, you do draw clients from across the state, right?
Oh, we do, yeah. We have four actual residential treatment programs. We have a detoxification residential or inpatient detox program. We have short-term residential treatment. We have a long-term residential treatment and for men and another one for women. And those all draw from really on a statewide basis. And then we have 7 outpatient clinics in Danbury, New Milford, Torrington, Waterbury, Derby, and New Haven, and mm-hmm. Ridgefield also. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty broad based and very comprehensive, and in all of these places we do not just treatment for people with substance use disorders, but we're rolling out nicotine addiction services and integrating that within the context of the substance abuse and also problem gambling. We're focused in on that.
Yeah, well, let's key in on those couple of things after just responding to just one more question. In terms of the age range of the folks that you serve, do you do you go as young as clients present, or do you have sort of do you deal with mostly adults?
No, we have some kids programs. We have actually a therapeutic group home. It's small, but for girls, that's, kids there 14, 15, 16, and then and we have a seniors program, so we serve people in their 80s. So it's, basically lifespan services. Most of our services, having said that, are towards young adults to middle-aged and a little bit above.
Mm. So before we get into talking about MCCA and how it's responding to the heroin and opioid epidemic here in Connecticut, let's key in on a couple of those other addictions that are sometimes companions to drug addiction or that stand on their own, perhaps in some cases in place of a drug addiction. In terms of the biology, the addiction thing sort of works on the same area of the brain, whether it's heroin, cocaine, gambling, nicotine. Tell us a little bit about the gambling component of your work.
Well, one of the things we're focusing on is that people come in with a substance use disorder, and then we find out that they also have a gambling addiction, and we kind of do co-occurring treatment at the same time. And probably half of the people we service with problem gambling come from our own population of clients that we're already servicing. And then we get referrals also on a statewide basis from that come in. There's this gambling hotline that people call in seeking help, and we get referrals.
Mm-hmm.
Referrals there also.
So not to get too deep in the weeds, but is there a difference between simultaneously treating a codependent situation versus someone who's either presenting only with a gambling issue or presenting only with a drug issue? Is it twice as hard or three times as hard?
Not necessarily. Well, we've also had experience where people come in with a gambling problem and find out that they have a serious substance use disorders. I remember a couple years ago, a guy came in for into our residential program for a gambling problem, and we determined, like his first day there, that he was addicted to heroin. So we had to detox him from heroin. So it actually enhances services. Whatever somebody comes in for, then we do a we try to treat the whole person. Let's put it that way, and rather than zero in on one particular thing or another. We try to meet them where they are and give them the help that they need on whatever their issues are, you know?
So where are you intaking or doing a gambling treatment or groups or any type of program like that throughout the jurisdiction of all of your offices and satellites? Or
Not all of them. We're doing... Danbury, in our output, all of our residential have the ability to do it, or our two of our residential, the Kent program and the short-term residential in Danbury. Mm-hmm. But then our Danbury, Waterbury, New Milford, and Torrington do the problem gambling services, simply because that's what we've been contracted with by the state.
I see.
To provide.
Very good. Folks, if you're listening and you want to find out more about what MCCA is doing or how close they are to helping you or someone you know or love, MCCAonline.com. MCCAonline.com is their website to go and learn more. Joe Sullivan is with us. He is CEO of MCCA, the Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism. So not to overshadow the chat we're going to have about some spectacular grants that were just delivered to MCCA, Joe, they may have overshadowed a little bit some grants or a grant that you got for smoking cessation, which you're really applying in a pretty innovative way.
Yeah, that was from the Department of Public Health, and it's a $400,000 grant for a two-year period, so we're really, it's sizable, and we're going to be able to do some really significant stuff with that, integrating it into all of our outpatient and residential treatment programs.
That's great. So, and also the smoking cessation can be a standalone for folks that just want to kick the habit. They're not really presenting with an alcohol or drug addiction, except for the nicotine.
Right. It's available to the general public just by, you know, calling and virtually walking in, getting to schedule an appointment and getting started on smoking. And we have, part of it is nicotine replacement therapy. So we have various medications that can be useful in the treatment of nicotine addiction. So we combine both the medication assisted with the psychosocial support that's needed. So
in terms of the nicotine addiction mitigation program or treatment programs, do you work a lot in conjunction with individuals' primary care physicians or other medical network support, or do you find that a lot of the folks that you're getting for the nicotine program particularly don't really either are coming to you uninsured, underinsured, or they're not coming on the advice of their medical physician, their primary physician?
Yeah, most of the people we service are insured. Connecticut has a high rate, you know, thanks to Connecticut's involvement with the Affordable Care Act and everything. And the Connecticut has, I think it's 97% of people in Connecticut are insured, either with public or private insurance. So most of them have insurance. We don't work as closely as we would like to with primary care physicians, and that's something that is on our list of priorities to work on over the next couple of years.
Okay.
Part of our strategic plan is to enhance collaboration with primary care physicians and other primary health care providers, and I'll talk about that in a little more when we get into the opiate and the heroin overdose situation in Connecticut.
Well, let's pick up on that right after the break. Folks, we are with Joe Sullivan. He's CCO of the Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism. MCCAonline.com is their website. If you'd like to learn more about the agency, perhaps consider making a donation to underwrite their programs, get involved in some volunteer or professional capacity, or just find out how MCCA might be able to help you or somebody that you love, a coworker, employee, what have you. MCCAonline.com. We're going to be back in just a minute. Stick with us and we'll talk about some exciting developments with MCCA, specifically to combat heroin and opioid epidemic that's gripping Connecticut. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. School and district leaders have an important role in ensuring a safe environment that affirms and supports transgender students. So with that in mind, CIRC of Middletown is presenting a talk for district and school leaders, school district attorneys, and Board of Education members entitled Schools in Transition, a Guide to Supporting Transgender Students in K-12 Schools. That event is happening February 10th from 9 to 10:30 a.m. If you'd like to learn more or make reservations, call 860-632-1485 or click on ctserc.org. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. We've got an important subject on the platform today. Joe Sullivan is with us. He is the CEO of the Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism. MCCA is their handle. MCCAonline.com is their website. We hope you'll visit and check with them and learn more about them, see how you could help or see how MCCA can help you. Sadly, between 2012 and 2014, the number of heroin and opioid related deaths in Connecticut more than doubled to 325. And if I understand correctly from other guests that have been on our program recently, in 2015, it became more than one opioid related death per day in Connecticut. Nationwide heroin related deaths nearly tripled between 2002 and 2013. So in response to that, MCCA, which has been working really, really hard for many, many years regarding opioid addictions, got some relief and an opportunity to really take hold and make a difference. Joe, tell us about these exciting new grant opportunities that have recently come your way.
Well, we, with the help of a couple of actually three different foundations, we were able to add staff at our New Milford clinic in particular, and because we wanted to focus in there. I think last year New Milford had four heroin overdose deaths, and you know, for a small town, that's dramatic. So mm-hmm. we've been able to add additional counselor in our New Milford office to focus on increased utilization and engagement of people with opiate addictions. And we're also in the process of recruiting what we call a recovery support specialist. One of the things, what we find is when people, there's this medication called Narcan, which is useful in resuscitating people or reviving people, whatever you want to say, who have had a heroin or an opiate overdose. And what we know from our own experience that people have OD'd on heroin and had to be revived by Narcan three or four times.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to work more closely with the hospitals so that if somebody is taken to the hospital by an ambulance or an administered Narcan by EMTs or a police officer, a lot of police officers are equipped and carry Narcan kits with them. But we want to have people, we want to be engaged with folks when they're revived. After they leave the emergency room, we want to be able to reach out with them and engage them in treatment. So we don't think, we think it's a comment on our system of care if people OD on and have to be revived three or four times on Narcan and haven't been engaged in treatment. So we want to work harder at that and collaborating with medical providers, particularly hospital ERs or emergency departments, on warm, quick handoffs.
Sure.
So that people can be engaged rapidly.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of disturbing to me to hear you say that, and I never thought of it that way. That once somebody is essentially dead of an opioid overdose and revived through Narcan, that you'd think that they would not only run, not walk for permanent treatment or support. But that that would be the final wake-up call, quite literally, and they wouldn't go back to the drugs. But now I'm hearing from you that apparently, you know, folks who can't kick or can't get the support they need, they're sort of relying on Narcan like some folks with heart problems are relying on nitroglycerin. It's just when it happens, they get the Narcan hopefully in time and are revived to get high again.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a conscious thing. I mean, part of it's a comment on the addictive properties of heroin and opiates.
Yeah.
We do know that nationwide, you know, that something like 75% of people who get addicted to heroin start off on use of prescription opiates.
Legitimate prescriptions sometimes.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's not legitimate for them. It's some diverted from, you know, family medicine cabinets and everything. But nevertheless, it's, you know, there's an over prescription of opiate-based pain medicine these days, and some of it gets into so-called recreational use, and then it leads to heroin addiction because the heroin's cheaper and easier to get than the prescription opiates. But I think the anyway, I mean, there's a lot of regulatory obstacles for achieving these warm handoffs, so to speak. You know, there's HIPAA confidentiality regulations and stuff like that. But there's ways that we can collaborate with you know, healthcare providers and emergency medical personnel and so forth to better connect to care. And that's a focus that we have, and we're working hard on.
Yeah. Well, to the credit to the credit of MCCA, you recently hosted two training sessions in the Greater Danbury area on the application of Narcan in the emergency situation. As we indicated, three grants totaling $22,500 coming to MCCA in the recent weeks to help combat the growing need for opiate treatment out of the New Milford Outpatient Clinic, the awards from United Savings Bank for $10,000, the Cowles Foundation for $2,500, and the Dirk Foundation for $10,000. A great injection of capital into a system that probably has need for much, much more. Joe Sullivan, in the last couple minutes that we have with you, can you just let folks know first how they can come to MCCA if they need help or a loved one needs help, and then close with how MCCA might be able to use the assistance of folks in either a underwriting or volunteer capacity?
Yes, first of all, the best way to get access service at MCCA is get on our website, and each of our outpatient clinics have walk-in days where you don't even need an appointment. You can just walk in one day a week at every one of our outpatient clinics. And we'll see you that day. We've staffed up on those walk-in days so that we can accommodate. So that's one way. Mm-hmm. You can schedule an appointment by just calling. And we're doing a lot of online communication now, too, so they can access us in that way, too. So I encourage people to get on our website and check us out. We always need, especially with the state, budget situation being what it is, and we don't expect it to get better anytime soon. We can always use donations and support, and every no donation is too small, and we appreciate that. And that can be used. I mentioned earlier that people have almost everybody's insured, but a lot of people have high deductibles, and that's a real obstacle to treatment. So. Sometimes we can the high deductibles and high copay, so contributions can be used to offset that for us, and that would be greatly appreciated. But and then volunteers, we can always use volunteers just by contacting us, shoot an email to me, or comment online, and we'll get back in touch with. Anybody, my email is jsullivan@mccaonline.com, and I would appreciate hearing from anybody who would be think they could make their help available to us mm-hmm. as a volunteer.
That's great. With our award-winning For the People broadcasting in Waterbury, in Torrington, in New Haven, in Western Connecticut, and up into the Hartford market, we are everywhere. MCCA is one of the largest providers of substance abuse treatment in Connecticut. They believe that alcoholism, drug addiction, problem gambling, and other co-occurring disorders are treatable, and that those affected, including family members, can recover. MCCAonline.com is the website for the Midwestern Connecticut Council of Alcoholism. And Joe Sullivan has once again graced our airwaves with his knowledge and presence. He's CEO of MCA. Joe, thank you so much for taking the time. Best of luck, and we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, about once a season, we check in with Will Ginsberg at the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, and we like to focus on all kinds of foundations out there. We have the foundation in the Naugatuck Valley. We've talked to foundations elsewhere in Connecticut. If you happen to be affiliated with a foundation somewhere in Connecticut, we'd love to hear from you. You can always get in touch with me through one of our radio stations. Just give us a call, and we'll be in touch. But today we're going to focus on a great partnership between the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and Alexion. Will, tell us a little bit about how this all came to be.
Sure, John. It's a pleasure to be with you again, as always. Alexion is a global pharmaceutical company, as your listeners may know, that started in New Haven almost 25 years ago as a startup. At Science Park, moved to Cheshire, and is just moving back to New Haven into a new global headquarters building right next to the School of Medicine at Yale and right next to downtown in the old Route 34 corridor. It's a spectacular thing for New Haven, and I think one of the great economic development stories in the history of this city. And Alexion has worked with the Community Foundation over the last several years. They've been supporters of our Great Give in each of the last several years. We have other relationships with the company and its senior people. So we were absolutely thrilled when they turned to us with an idea to mark their return to New Haven and the opening of their building with a charitable giving program. Alexion is working with us, is going to make 30 grants over 30 business days between now and the end of February, when they will formally cut the ribbon on their new building, and to selected nonprofits throughout this community, throughout New Haven, covering the full range of different types of charitable activity in our community. I think it's a strong powerful signal of Alexion's commitment to the community, not only as its location and in terms of its relationship to Yale and everything else it does here, and but also in terms of its relationship to the nonprofit sector and all the important work that that the local nonprofits do here to make life better in New Haven. So we're thrilled to be working with Alexion. We're thrilled at this commitment. We're thrilled that they're back in New Haven, and it's a great thing in so many different ways.
Excellent. Well, folks, you may want to follow along at home as these grants roll out. They can do that daily on GiveGreater.org's Facebook page and Twitter feed. Here in New Haven grants is what they're being called.
So,
Will, is this a first of its kind promotional partnership for between the foundation and a commercial partner, large or small?
I think certainly we've worked with a lot of companies in New Haven, but most of our work is with individual donors, and we work with nonprofits, on investment management, et cetera. So I think basically, John, yes, it is. I think to have a company that steps up and does a month-long set of giving like this and uses the resources, the community knowledge resources, givegreater.org specifically, which is a comprehensive database that the Community Foundation has created with almost 300, with detailed profile information of almost 350 nonprofit organizations in Greater New Haven, to use Give Greater as the source for making these choices and to use the Community Foundation as the vehicle to make these grants, this is a first. And it is, as I said before, it's great from our standpoint. It's exactly how we hope other organizations, be they for-profits or nonprofits and other institutions in our community, will use the information and the knowledge that that we've put out on the web through givegreater.org.
Well, you know better than anybody, Will Ginsberg, that the difference between $0 and $1,000 can make a difference in the lives of dozens, maybe even hundreds of people, depending on how it's applied. We are going to be actually talking to a representative of one of these here in New Haven grants from Alexion in just a couple minutes at Columbus House. But as we record this the Thursday before broadcast, we've already heard the announcement of the second here in New Haven Alexion Community Foundation grantees. Will, I understand it's one of the partnering Hispanic support organizations that...
Yes, it's an arts organization, actually, that's very active in the Latino community, called ARTE, A-R-T-E, ARTE Inc., which is a great organization that we've been privileged to know and support for a number of years, and that has done so much to build and support Latino cultural activities in New Haven. So it's a great second choice, very different, of course, than Columbus House, which is also a great choice and one of the linchpin organizations in our local nonprofit sector, serving some of the most needy people in our community, the homeless population. So, and I think those two choices, we'll see 30 of them over the next month, but I think those two choices speak to the breadth of Alexion's vision of what kind of organizations it wants to touch through its Here in New Haven initiative.
And that initiative is one of so many that are celebrating the generosity of three generations of donors throughout the Greater New Haven region. The Community Foundation for Greater New Haven awarded over $30 million in grants and distributions just last year from charitable assets of more than $500 million. And they are serving folks and organizations in communities in a 20-town area, Ansonia, Bethany, Brantford, Cheshire, Derby, East Haven, Guilford, Hamden, Madison, Milford, New Haven, North Brantford, and then in North Haven, Orange, Oxford, Seymour, Shelton, Wallingford, West Haven, and Woodbridge. If you would like to learn more about the foundation or how you can get involved, perhaps setting up something to remember you by for many years to come, go to cfgnh.org. Or once again, you're welcome to follow the recipients of the Alexion Greater New Haven Foundation Here in New Haven grants on givegrader.org. A complete listing of all grantees will be listed there at the close of this granting period at the end of February, or you could follow along as those grants are presented on givegrader.org's Facebook page and Twitter feed. We're going to say farewell to Will Ginsberg, President and CEO of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, and hear a little bit more about how the Here in New Haven grant is being applied at Columbus House. Will, we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, John.
All right, John Brooks is with us on the line now. He's Director of Development at Columbus House. John, thanks for checking in on the program. We appreciate your taking a few minutes today.
Thanks for having me, John.
So first, for the folks that may not be familiar, give them the quick lowdown on what Columbus House is all about and the great work you guys do over there.
Well, Columbus House is, we're more than a shelter. We started out 33 years ago as just a shelter, providing the basic provisions, and we've grown into a homeless services agency that provides not only shelter, but our main goal now is to get people housed. So we have every program is designed to get people out of the shelters quickly and into housing. So we have employment service programs. We have programs specifically for women with mental health issues. We have programs specifically for veterans. And we have programs for families with children.
Fantastic. So as we sort of alluded to with Will, Alexion, in conjunction with the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, has come up with this Here in New Haven charitable giving initiative that's going to award 30 grants over 30 business days leading up to Alexion's occupancy in their new New Haven headquarters. Very exciting stuff there on both fronts.
Absolutely.
But we talked a little bit about, you know, when you talk about $1,000 to any kind of a foundation, it seems like a drop in the bucket when you think of all the need and all the good that needs to be done. But could you give us a little bit of an idea of how that $1,000 might translate into end user services, or in fact, how many people might actually end up in some way, shape, or form, benefiting from that seemingly nominal grant?
All right. Well, that's a great question, and let me give you a little background. So Columbus House, you know, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and my staff is in charge of raising funds through individuals and corporations, foundations, events, mail, and so on. And we get the bulk of our support is government grants and contracts. However, we have to apply for those every year, and we're never guaranteed to receive those grants. And as you know, with the volatility of the state budget, we never know if we're going to get these grants or not. And so my department is charged with raising money that these grants and contracts, by their very nature, require us to you know, match or put up a part of the total budgeted amount. So let's say we get a a couple hundred thousand dollar grant from a state or federal entity, we may be required to raise $20,000 or $30,000 of that total through private means. And so every dollar that we raise counts. So $1,000 is a significant amount of money. You know, our bread and butter is individuals who send in $25, $50, $100. Mm. And so my office alone raises about $1 million a year just to fill those gaps. And also, John, it allows us to seek out new opportunities that perhaps we don't have state funding for. And seek out a new property or a new program. A few years ago, we were able to take over the Middlesex Family Shelter and Services from the Red Cross, who was leaving that area, and so that program was left without an agency to run it. And so, those things cost money, and we're able to use money for those types of things to explore new programs and new opportunities.
Well, that's fantastic. So before we let you go, and on a wider perspective, this is really just a representation of the type of support that you, Columbus House, and so many other organizations in the region have been able to benefit from thanks to the foundation.
Absolutely, absolutely. Last year we served 2,610 people, 56 families, and 138 children. So, you know, when you ask where does the $1,000 go, it helps us to provide program support to help all those people, get out of the shelter system and into housing. We were able to house 639 people last year. And so it's more than just sheltering people. It's getting people housed. And so every dollar that we raise goes towards our goal of getting people quickly out of the shelter system and into housing.
Fantastic. How can people learn more about what Columbus House is doing?
We have a great website. It's very informative. It's www.columbushouse.org. And there's updated information all the time. There's wish list items on there all the time. And on March 13th, we're doing our annual Chocolate to the Rescue fundraiser up in Middletown to benefit our family shelter. And so, come out and join us for that and visit the webpage for other ways that you can help.
Excellent. John Brooks, Director of Development at Columbus House, the first of 30 Alexion Pharmaceutical Community Foundation for Greater New Haven Partnership here in New Haven Charitable Grants. Closing the show today, we thank you, John, as well as Will Ginsberg, for being part of the program this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big.